How can you meditate on Brahman? There's nothing there to meditate on. There's no features. So it doesn't really have any meaning. You say meditate on Brahman. Meditate on the sound of one hand clapping. Yes, in the back there.
Asking this question of previously you were asking the attention to our Param Dashto Anivardhate. Again coming back to the point that of a neophyte devotee when he is practicing. So certain times he feels joy in some activity. At the same time, in the same activity he will not feel joy. Another way, what happens, the certain kind of things which will be suit to our kind of setup or psyche. So how we can know that this is actually the same Param Dashtva or the spiritual enjoyment or spiritual taste, rather than even a materialist when he works outside, he gets some taste and work like a, you know, like anything.
Alright. How can we know whether our taste is coming from our Swadharma or from our bhakti?
Yeah, that's a question.
Well, before we try to answer that, I think that we should also accept that, you know, there's some pleasure in Swadharma, which is not bad. There's nothing wrong with that. To get pleasure from your work, as if your work is directed towards the Lord, that's okay. It's not going to take you away from the Lord. It's helping to connect you to the Lord in yoga, so it's good. Just like I was doing every kind of service you can imagine in ISKCON. You know, I was a pot washer, book distributor, BBT manager, I was a temple commander, I was a head pujari, I was a temple president, I was a college preacher, and I was a kitchen manager. You know, I did everything. And after about 14 years, I started teaching. And that was also kind of an accident, you know. Somebody asked me to come and do Bhagavad Gita seminar in 1991. Right? And it's like, when I started teaching, I felt this surge of energy and enthusiasm and kind of, I don't know, like, just pleasure also. And I realized that, wow, I never felt that before. It was kind of like, you know, it's like you're swimming for 14 years and then suddenly there's this, you know, push and you go so I felt like that, this immense energy and enthusiasm and like, so then I realized that that's, you know, what is this? And I realized that that's Swadharma. It's my nature, is to teach. And I was doing all these other things. I also got some taste for them, preaching and, you know, distributing books and for years and this and that. But when I started teaching, there was some extra, you know, turbocharge, you know, extra boost of energy. So then I realized, okay, that's the material thing. But I didn't accept it as a bad thing. I thought, wow, this is great. I thought, it's good. And it's pushing me towards the Lord, so okay, let it push. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's how you can tell the difference, is that the energy comes from a particular activity of one of the varnas, right? And that will take each person maybe 5 years, maybe 8 years, maybe 10 years, and or in my case, I was very slow, 14 years. So, of course, brahmacharis generally didn't think about that so much, because grihasthas, they consider it more because they have to work in the world and they have to figure out what kind of work can I do which is going to be the most easy for me to make money and to live and like this. But still, brahmacharis also will gradually, probably like I did, accidentally stumble upon their varna. And then when it happens, it like you feel some the boost of energy. And so then you'll know that's the material thing. Okay, fine. And you accept it, you know. Like some people need to get married, you know, and then when they get married, they feel some energy and they feel their senses, you know, more strong or like this. So that's the material thing. Also, varna and ashram. And, you know, when you feel a boost of energy from, you know, like you go through a period where your japa is becoming really good and you're feeling energy from that, then that's the spiritual thing. Or when it's coming from, you know, your study of the shastras, then generally it's also the spiritual thing. Or when it's from preaching, or when it's from, you know, deity worship, or something like this, then it's the spiritual thing. Kirtan, right? So, I mean, in general, you can discriminate with your intelligence between what kind of taste you're getting at Paramdrishma. Is it from the spiritual or from the material side? There's one devotee in the back that's been patiently waiting to answer this question.
Actually, it's the same question.
And he's probably, okay, well, he can make a comment. Alright, let him
comment.
Okay, well, same question. Is there a question on this topic also? Alright, let him then, and we'll get to him. You can.
As you said that, you know, you develop a kind of taste for a particular activity, and you develop, and you realize that it's actually much more than that. It's not actually a spiritual gift, but it's something like which you are
okay, but there's also inclination or proclivity towards particular angas of bhakti. And Prabhupada describes in the nectar devotion that some devotees will like to chant, some devotees will like to deep worship the deity, some devotees will like something else, you know, a different activity, spiritual angas of bhakti. You know, some devotees would like to write about Krishna. And so he said that a devotee should, you know, perform those activities that he feels most inclined towards. That's also in devotion, but it has to do with the various angas of bhakti. Sure. So that's also
like, for example, even if they appear like direct devotional service, like, you know, decorating the deity.
Yeah.
But even in that, there is, if a person wants to be you know, material conscious, as he can be.
Yes.
If a person, you know, has a habit of, you know, just decorating something, like maybe a table or maybe his desktop, he wants like to decorate, then if he goes to the altar, he would just do that for the Lord.
Yes.
So, I mean, but is there any significance in, because I was told that one must still, whatever may be, like for example, say I have a taste for, you know, doing, sweeping the floor, I feel very ecstatic in sweeping the floor.
Achcha.
So, now, say, okay, for example, I'll take another example. Because sweeping the floor is also, in one sense, direct devotional service, in one sense, can be related. But like, for example, say,
I personally, I like, say, opening up or say, an amplifier set, you know, just seeing, you know, what's wrong.
You like toying around with the gadgets and
something
stuff.
Like that. Right? Now, for example, now, that may not be directly related to anywhere with, you know, with the Lord or with angas of devotion.
It's called dovetailing.
So is it true that one has to develop still some taste in direct devotional service? You know, you should somehow develop. Or is, can this be considered direct or how? I'm not
even understanding the question. Rupa Goswami stresses that if you look in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and if you, especially if you look in the commentaries, then you'll see that he stresses direct inner bhakti activities, mainly chanting Hare Krishna. Yeah. Because, you know, when you're chanting Hare Krishna, it's like nothing else is going on except for bhakti. Right? At least for a devotee. We're not talking about mayavadis or something. So, we are performing, you know, Prabhupada said work now, samadhi later. Because, you know, when people come, everybody begins from, you know, more or less from this level, or maybe this, or something, on a very low level. You know, we're attached to the results of our work, we're attached to the work, we're attached to what people think of us, we're attached to everything, which is material. And we're trying to kind of get a footing in bhakti. But we're Kanishtha Adhikaris, so we're actually not Vaishnavas, we're Bhakta Abhas. Right? Bhakta Abhas. Bhakta Abhas. A Vaishnava Praya. Almost a Vaishnava. So, therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that in the beginning you can't just throw out all karma and jnana, because then you'll have nothing there, because there's not much bhakti there. So we have to just dovetail whatever we can do. You know, in the beginning it might be more tail than dove. That was a joke. And more tail, dovetail, you know. but that's okay. But of course we're doing okay. So we're doing like Daivi Varnashram, kind of karma yoga or something. You know. It's a kind of bhakti, but it's like a reflected kind of bhakti. It's not sort of siddha bhakti. It's like sangha siddha bhakti, something like this. But that's okay. But we're also chanting, and that's, you know, direct shuddha bhakti. That's the highest thing, you know. That's why devotees have a tough time chanting japa, because they're not on that platform. There's not much taste, and plus to control the mind is like really painful, you know. So, but we keep doing it every day, and you know, after 20 years, the things start clearing away, and then you know, you get some taste starts to come, and then it becomes more gradually situated in the real direct bhakti, ananya bhakti. And all the other things gradually are displaced. The taste that you have from fiddling around, you know, with his gadgets or driving a car. Some devotees, like there was one devotee in the Bhaktivedanta Manor, Bhakti Mark, and he used to be like a race car driver. So guess what he started doing when he became the temple devotees? He was the driver and he was driving everybody. We pick up the sannyasis at the airport and driving here and there. And it was obvious that, you know, he was enjoying his, you know, his material proclivity. But that was making him happy, and he was also chanting and going to the kirtan. It's like everybody, that's how everyone starts, you know. So there's nothing really wrong with that. As long as they keep chanting, then everything will happen. If they give up the chanting and they just start doing that work, then they won't get anywhere. Because in the beginning of our movement, there was a lot of stress also on just results and activity and working and like this. And a lot of devotees also, they didn't have so much taste for chanting. So one devotee came to in a class, it was at the end of a class, Prabhupada was giving a class how all the angas are equal, they're all spiritual. And the devotee raised his hand and said, but if all the activities of Krishna consciousness are equal on their own spiritual platform, why do we have to chant japa? So Prabhupada explained, well, chanting japa is the actual essence, and Lord Chaitanya recommended us, and all of our acharyas have told us this is our the most important of the activities, so we must chant. And then the boy continued, kind of pressing Prabhupada. He asked the same thing, but if all the activities are equal and they're all on the spiritual platform, why can't we just do our services? Why do we have to chant? And Prabhupada said, because the Supreme Personality of Godhead wants you to chant Hare Krishna. And then he looked at the devotee very compassionately and he said, I bless you. I give you a special blessing. You can eat and sleep all day. Just chant your 16 rounds. Because Prabhupada knew that if he kept chanting, then he will gradually start doing some service. Because he'll feel, you know, he'll be connected. But if he gives up chanting and just does the service, then after a while think, why am I doing all this work for nothing? I'm not getting paid. I'll just go out and do works outside like this. Maybe that's a little bit diverting from the question, but the direct chanting is the most important. We do have to develop a taste for that, and that's why we do it every day. In the meantime, we do some seva, and if we can do a seva that we like, that's good, that's the best. We shouldn't avoid the service that we like just because we like it. Because that's just foolish. You know, why should we have a society of all dissatisfied people who are doing something that they don't like? You know? It makes a lot more sense to, you know, engage people in the things that they like to do. And then you have a whole community of very satisfied, blissful, you know, people walking around with smiles on their faces, and, you know, right? Because otherwise, you know, again, you come to community, everyone's walking around like this. What do you want here? What are you doing here? Rather, we're just happy. Whether it's from our sort of dharma or whether it's from bhakti, let's get some pleasure. Right? We have to get some kind of pleasure. Gradually the pleasure will become more pure towards just loving Krishna. To the point where, you know, you just, when you're 80 years old, you'll be in your bhajan kuti, you're just remembering leelas of Radha and Krishna. Right? You don't have to do anything, and you can't do anything because your body's all broken and you're too old to do any work now. But anyway, we shouldn't be afraid of having some pleasure, even if it's just from our material nature. That's okay. The material nature is also given to us by Krishna. He's the one who gave us this body and according to our desires in the past life. You can't jump up to the Paramahamsa stage in 3 years, or five, or ten. You know, you have to, whole life. All the purity of bhakti will come. We just have to perform our ordinary devotional duties along with chanting. And everything gradually is adjusted along the way by Krishna. Because Krishna's, he loves us and he arranges for each person to get what they need. So if Krishna's arranging for us to get what we need and then we say, no, I can't do that. Well, why not? Well, because I like that. What's wrong with you? Krishna's arranging for you to do that. So, then do it. But then just try to think of Krishna. That's all. While you're doing it.
Okay.
Arjuna was in this beginning of the chapter. Arjuna was confusing what is what to do and what to do. Even he was
what
crying,
to do and what not to do.
He was crying.
He was crying. Yes.
So, and in this say at the end of the chapter, he is becoming like more and more inquisitive about all this. First, like Krishna is making him, as we said, confusing, more and more confusing.
All right. By the way, that's the first question that Arjuna asks. And there's 16 questions throughout Bhagavad Gita. And he's asking about the Sthita Pragya.
So, as a, on behalf of all the conditioned souls, he's representing that, and that they should ask this question, like, he's representing all the conditioned souls. So, as they approach this Gita, so they end up with some this Karma Yoga, or this, whatever, Dhyana Yoga, or Jnana Yoga, and just they just stop there. They don't perform the Bhakti Yoga. Even the chapter is also mentioned as content of summarized Gita, but it just gives a drop of Bhakti.
Yeah.
All the things it explains about Vishram Karma and Karma Yoga.
Yeah.
So it makes a... That's what I heard.
From?
Many devotees.
From many devotees.
They become like Ashtang Yogis and they don't... Many, even Krishna says that Manushyanam Sarvishtu. Ashtang. Out of 1,000 people, like, just come up in an understanding.
But he didn't say of the thousands of people who read the Bhagavad Gita. A thousand of the Jnanis.
So why they end up with just only Ashtanga Yoga and like, so much confusion for them to understand?
No, but your question is based upon this, you know, questionable observation. Right? Which I don't think is true. Which, at least we should say it's questionable. Because you're saying so many people, they approach the Bhagavad Gita and they end up as Karma Yogis and Ashtanga Yogis, but I never met them. Who are these people? Where are they? I don't know. I see these people, they're the ones who read the Bhagavad Gita and they became devotees. Now, maybe there are societies of people who are Ashtanga Yogis and Karma Yogis. I mean, I never heard of the Karma Yoga Society, International Society for Karma Yogi, yep, Karma Yoga, but I guess there are, maybe in India at least. But I don't think that they got it completely all from just reading the Bhagavad Gita. You know what I mean? The people who do Ashtanga Yoga, generally, they don't study Bhagavad Gita. They study the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, more or less. I mean, you have chapter 6, okay, it mentions, it does have a description of Ashtanga Yoga. But at the end, he says, of all the yogis, the one who thinks of me with love and faith, he is the best. You know, so, if the person's reading it, then he comes, was he going to read and then just not read the last shloka in chapter 6.
But somehow they are putting faith in the God's word, Krishna's word, following these things.
People can misuse, but, you know, I mean anything, but I think in general, we can't overgeneralize and say that most of the people are becoming karma yogis and jnana yogis and Ashtanga yogis from reading Bhagavad Gita. Most people read Bhagavad Gita and they just go on with their material life. At least the other Bhagavad Gitas. Because there were, Prabhupada says, there was 200 versions of Bhagavad Gita in English and no one was becoming any kind of yogi. You know? And then when he translated his book, then thousands of people became bhakti yogis. So, I mean, I don't know what it's like in India, but when I was preaching in Gujarat in 86, you know, I'm talking about, like 17 years ago, almost 20 years ago, and I was really afraid, oh, they all know Bhagavad Gita, I better study and learn the verses, da-da-da-da-da. And then I went into the schools and the universities, and I was quoting so many verses, and everyone was, you know, shocked at a foreigner, ungrazy, knows all these, you know, Bhagavad Gita slogans. And then I said, you know this verse? And they said, no, you know that verse? No. Have you ever read the Bhagavad Gita? No. And then I said, what? You never read the Bhagavad Gita? They said, no. And I said, wow. And so that anyone here that's read the Bhagavad Gita, please raise your hand. It was like two people out of 200, you know. I said, wow, what's going on in India, man? Come on, you know. These people are completely lost. They never even read the Bhagavad Gita. It's the most basic book, and you know. most people, you know, and this, I'm talking about 17 years ago, so they're like in their 30s now, right? They never read the Bhagavad Gita. And I think it's much worse now. Instead of 1%, it's maybe 0.01% or something like that. Very few people are into religion, you know, amongst the universities and common people. There's very little bit, practically nobody's. They're studying, you know, the microword soft manuals nowadays. You know? Not reading Bhagavad Gita. Very few people study Bhagavad Gita. So anyway, I think that your question is based on some kind of misobservation of, at least from my subjective viewpoint. The purpose, well, why Krishna gives all these yoga systems is because in bhakti yoga, there's all of these other components. So to really understand bhakti yoga completely, you have to learn these other yoga systems. And Krishna's trying to like draw in all of these other kinds of people. Because there's basically three kinds of people. Karmis, jnanis, and yogis. And devotees, Karmis, jnanis, and devotees. So, the Bhagavad Gita is divided in these three sections. It covers all the philosophy in anywhere in the universe. Because that's it. You have karma, jnana, and bhakti. So, the people that are inclined towards enjoying in karma, they can enter bhakti through the first six chapters. And the people inclined through jnana, negating things, you know, they can enter through the last six chapters. That attracts them. But all of those verses, every chapter, and it all directs towards person towards bhakti. And this way Krishna is like tricking everyone. It's like in like a needle, out like a plow. Because you start reading about this and this and this and yoga, and then at the end it's always like, and the best of all of these yogis, the ones who surrender to me, matpara, and so forth. So that's, you know, I mean, I think Krishna knows what he's doing. The Gita is, you know, very intelligently laid out. And if you stick around, you'll see. You know, people become devotees from it. Either they become devotees or they just don't listen to it at all. You know, I think very few people become other kinds of yogis. And unless their teacher is just teaching them just the first six chapters or the last six chapters. And then the teacher is a jnani or a karmi yogi. And then he's saying, this is the ultimate thing in the Gita. But then the students have to be really dull. Because, you know, in every chapter, Krishna is talking about bhakti. He says in many places, you know. Okay, some more questions? Yes?
Karma and Karma Yoga. In both of them,
Karma Kanda
and Karma Yoga, in both places, activity is being done. Is it just a matter of consciousness being changed from duty mentality to purification mentality? Or are the procedures with the method of worship which they adopt, is there also change in the yajnas which they do, the karma kandi they do yajnas for going to heaven? So what does karma yogi actually do as a part of the procedure?
Karma yogis. Well, because the objective is now elevated to the eternal realm. So therefore, all of these yajnas for, you know, health and wealth and longevity and beautiful wife and, you know, money, all of these things are now, you know, disregarded in general. At least there's a direction towards leaving them behind. And the things for, you know, going to higher planets, this is also left behind. So the karma yogi, he will focus more on giving the fruits of his work to the Supreme. And this way he gets purification. There may still remain some of the old habits and some whatever, you know, yajnas. But gradually that will drop. Because the person, his interest will be for purification. And then, I mean, there's also, in both of them there's emphasis on Swadharma and Varnashram Dharma. So, you know, pleasing the sadhus and worshipping the cow and, you know, avoiding sin and performing the Pancha Mahayagya, you know, Manusha Yagya, Brahma Yagya, you know, Bhuta Yagya. They do some sacrifice, they're feeding people and living entities, and they study the Vedas and like this. So the selfishness of those only karmakanda rituals are gradually left behind by those persons because they're becoming more selfless and more more elevated. I would imagine that there's kind of a gradual, an overlapping and a gradual renouncing of various previous rituals. Worshipping Indra and Agni for this and that. I mean, I personally never went through that phase, so I can't give you the exact description, you know, perhaps, you know. Okay.
So with the Karma Karma Yogi, he establishes Krishna as the goal, and actually that has the roots of his work. And Shankaranga Yogi is actually regarded as this. I have a question there.
Ashtanga Yoga?
Yeah. No. Nishkama Karma.
Nishkama.
He is detached from the truth. So
In both the cases,
and is attached to the work. No.
Yeah. In both the cases of the Kama and Nishkama Karma Yogis, to whom do they actually offer? Do they know Krishna is the absolute truth, or is there a Panchopasana they say, like Vishnu, Surya? So do they offer truth like that with a lack of understanding, or do they know Krishna to be the absolute truth, source of everything?
Well, those who are Bhagavad Arpitas, they worship either Ram or Vishnu or Krishna. Right? But those who are not, who knows what they are? They could be of all different kinds, yeah, Panchapasanawalas or, you know, that's not very good, because it's, you know, like demigods, worshipping demigods, but it's better than nothing, you know. It's at least in the right direction. Even in Panchapasana, there's like a gradual elevation of one deity to the next, to the next, to the next. And Vishnu's at the top and Devi's on the bottom. Then there's Devi and Ganesh, and the next, and then Mahadev, and then Surya, and then Vishnu. So, yeah, everything in the Vedic scenario is geared towards gradual elevation. And of course, those who worship Vishnu in that mood, it's not really bhakti, but it's closer to bhakti. At least when they're focusing on Vishnu, they can jump to bhakti. You know, they can get influenced by it. They have to meet a Shuddha Bhakta. Shuddha Bhakta Charanare Bhajana Ankula. Right? So that's the thing that brings them. In actually all of these situations, the Vaishnava Sangha is the most potent way to elevate, to go up, up, up. That's about them.
I asked earlier, well, here the speech was how bhakti is elusive.
What?
Elusive.
Elusive, yes. The elusive butterfly of bhakti.
Yeah, earlier you had mentioned that one's authority, it depends on one's adhikar or how one gets bhakti. So,
but that's a special adhikar.
Yeah. My question was, if there is such an elaborate system of religion, you know, in which, of Karmakanda, in which the soul is clearly understood, when we're talking about elevation to heavenly planet, then why is bhakti not given prominence? If one understands that I am not the body and the soul, then immediately the logical question will be, what is the ultimate goal? So, you say that if we compare the people of earlier religions to present, so we are even more disqualified as compared. They were at least somewhat religious. Now people are on the animal level. So, if we say Prabhupada's compassion, then where the Vaishnava was not compassionate earlier, it seems just like
very thoughtful man, aren't you? Yeah, Sita Dear Muni, huh?
It seems like just like we have a scientific sort of education which misleads people. So even the Vedic culture, it seems to be a karma-friendly form of education which keeps people away from bhakti. So how is it that?
Yeah, it does. It kind of keeps them busy in their, you know, material religious mentality. That's true. You know, there's many pious people in India who are not devotees, but they're really pakka, dharma, you know, dharma walas, you know, really very religious, and even sophisticated and gentle. Mm-hmm. But that's not enough, you know. It's not enough. It's favorable because they, such people who are religious, they generally, you know, serve sadhus. They may not be able to discriminate, you know, between the real pure devotee and some brahmavadi or some yogi guy, you know, tapasvi. But they generally feel respectful towards sadhus. So therefore they give some donation or food, or they give some lodging, and in this way they serve sadhus. And, you know, if they, if they're fortunate, they do some of this sukriti, which is bhakti umuki sukriti, a transcendental piety, devotional piety, then gradually that builds up and they can come to bhakti. But the rituals of karmakanda are simultaneously gradually beneficial and simultaneously kind of bewildering and obstructing people from attaining bhakti. And it depends on the individual soul. That individual soul, if he has some slight spark of desire, and if he has some just moment association of serving the sadhu, because even in ignorance, if it's a jnata sukriti, a jnata bhakti umuki sukriti, then, but he can become a devotee gradually through serving sadhus generally. And if that, you know, the person's really kind of envious or very selfish and somehow doesn't like sadhus and whatever, he can just continue with his rituals and like this for many births. Since Lord Chaitanya came, things have changed a lot because he's God himself and he introduced the chanting, and just by seeing him people became devotees, and then those people traveled and others who just saw them became devotees. I mean, just falling down with prema, you know, bhakti surging through their veins. It was like that. So there was a great influx of mercy by Mahaprabhu and all of those who are following in his line. And that is, you know, I mean, that's Mahaprabhu's reason for coming, to give mercy. He is the embodiment of Kripa Shakti because he is Radha and Krishna combined together. And because the Lord is tasting so much nectar from experiencing Radha Bhav, that he wants to distribute it freely, whether the people are qualified or not. Mage va, no mage keha, patra va, apatra. Ihar vichar nahi. Jani Deya Matra. So he only distributes whether the people live. In fact, he's called Patita Pavana. He's like looking for people who are unqualified. And so Prabhupada went to New York, which is probably the most sinful place on the earth planet. And there, you know, he elevated people. So it's like, you know, that's really what Patita Pavana means. So the general traditional Vedic scenario is not really so much in place right now. It's more like, you know, based on mercy. Of course, those devotees who come from Brahmin families in South India, like particularly, you know, it's very good samskars, that's the best. But if they become proud because of that, then it's all wasted. Better to, you know, be an angrezi, you know, who comes to Krishna consciousness and never feels himself proud of his, you know, family lineage, than to be from Paka Brahmin family from Karnataka and, you know, know Sanskrit and da-da-da, and be very gentle and have a beautiful face. But, and then become proud of it, it spoils everything. Because then Krishna won't give you any bhakti. Because in the Puranas it says, ahankara nivrittanam keshava nahi durada. Someone who's free from ahankara, then keshava's never very far away. But ahankara pravittanam madhye parvata rashaya. Then huge mountains stand between the Lord and the person who is proud. You know. So, I mean, that principle is very strong because Mahaprabhu said, Tradana Pisvinichana. That is our, Bhaktisiddhanta said, this is our Siddha Pranali mantra. It means the process for perfection is through humility. Even the person may not know, can't even chant one shloka from Bhagavad Gita. I think Prabhupada quoted this from South India. The Brahmin, was he Brahmin? Or anyway, he couldn't read. He was illiterate. Right? And Mahaprabhu accepted him. Because the person was at least trying to follow the order of his guru. And people were laughing at him. So, but he said, that you are the real knower of the Bhagavad Gita. So we really, all of these, the Vedic traditional practice is, it can be very helpful. But then we have to really be careful. Sadhu sadhana. Be careful. Don't become proud.
The proper life in the preface, how the demoniac education is misleading people regarding the right understanding of the simple principles of life.
Material education?
Yeah. Misleading people regarding right understanding of the simple principles of life.
Mm.
Now we are not the body of soul, we are the overlist and all that.
Mm.
So, in the Vedic times, all this basic education of the ultimate goal of life, it is to go back to Godhead, given to the brahmacharis, and then they were allowed, if you want, you can do karmakanda also or some clarification. Or was even this knowledge hidden? So, like Brahma, in Brahma Samhita, Brahma says that Vedantasya Santaha Kshiti Viral Charaha Satipai. That this is not known, this knowledge about spiritual world is not known even to Santas. So was it that they were given knowledge and then given choice? Or was even the knowledge not given?
Well, first of all, it's like saying, do all Catholics, you know, when they die, where do they go? I say, you know, all Catholics means, you know, 1.2 billion people or whatever. And you can't paint everyone with the same brush. So, you know, in Vedic times, the brahmacharis means there's like, you know, 127 varieties or whatever. Right? Because the brahmacharis training is obviously going to be based completely on his guru. And there's many kinds of gurus. There's Karmakanda gurus, there's Jnana Yoga gurus, there's Ashtanga Yoga gurus, there's Tapasvi gurus, there's Bhakti gurus who are doing mostly Nishkam Karma Yoga, and then there's, you know, Aishwarya Jnana Yukta Bhakti Yogi gurus, you know. I mean, there's so many different kinds of persons, and you can't really just say, you know, during the Vedic times, was it like this? Because during that time, it's just like similar to this time in the sense that there's quite a big variety, a whole plethora of various kinds of yogis and gurus and swamis and tapasvis and ascetics who have all different ideas. And they're training their brahmacharis in a particular way. So, but, you know, I mean, Krishna's fulfilling the desires of the soul. So naturally, if a person has some bhakti mukhi sukriti in his heart, then he will gravitate towards bhakti to that degree. And then that bhakti guru, that Vaishnava guru, will very clearly point out what is the prayojan. And other persons will obscure that prayojan according to their leaning, according to their understanding. Even during the time of Mahaprabhu, most of the Navadvipa Brahmins were into Nyaya and Vyakaran and maybe some, Kali Puja, and that was it. There was practically no one. It's just Advaita Acharya and some few Vaishnavas were getting together for Vaishnava Sangha and Bhagavad Katha. And they were crying because they saw that the whole city of Navadvipa was filled with all these thousands of pundits and Brahmins, and none of them were devotees. They're all materialists, some speculators and logicians, and some, worshippers of Kali or just karmis and karmakam and walis. It was an unfortunate situation at that time. So it's hard to today it's also bad, and then it was bad. I mean, it just means you can conclude that we're very fortunate that we are being like on a silver platter. The Goswamis went through all the Pancharatras, Puranas, all the Itihasas, all of the this and that, and they just pulled out everything that we need, and it made it very simple. And then Prabhupada even made it more simple, because otherwise you can study the Vedas, Vedeshu Dulabha. But when one has bhakti, then it becomes easy. Dulabha, Atma Bhakti, he is guided by the Lord in the heart through all of the array of the Vedic scenario, through all the yogis and the gyanis and the karma pandavalas and this and that, ascetics and tapasvis, and they just come, Krishna, like a magnet. Krishna directly attracts them. And that's described in the 6th chapter of the Gita, how they take birth again and they automatically become attracted by the yogic principles. They're no longer attracted by the lower things. So someone who has some bhakti, he's automatically attracted to bhakti. So as far as the history of the world is concerned, it kind of goes like this, We can't say that, at a certain time the sadhus were more merciful than they are now, or they're more merciful now. But they're always merciful. If you can get one, if you can find one, I mean, how many Prabhupadas are there now? Other than, Prabhupada's disciples, how many, pure Vaishnavas are traveling and preaching? Not so many. There's some, but not so many. And during the time of Mahaprabhu, there was also a great dearth of, Vaishnava sadhus. But then, it increased. But then by the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, it also disappeared. What happened to all the Vaishnava sadhus? They all, it was like all Kapalika, Tantra, Walas, and Sannyasis, and really became really perverted. The whole thing was degraded. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur and his son began preaching, and they created the whole thing all over again. And now Prabhupada is preaching, has been preaching, and now we're preaching. And who would have thought that, I came to Pune in 1981 and there was no temple here, and we went to some hotel or some dharmashala of a life member with Sridhar Maharaj. And there was this one guy that came, to sit with us. He had all red clothes. He was a foreigner. And we welcomed him, you know. And then he was from the, you know, which group they were? Bhagavan. And so he sat for, you know, Bhagavad Prasad. And then a lady came up, also wearing red clothes, and she whispered something into his ear. And then he said, no, I'm having some dinner with these nice people, you go away and I'll come later. So then the lady was quiet for a moment, he was eating, but she didn't go away. Then she came to him again, and she said, psst. And he said, no, not now, please later, let me finish my meal. And then she stood there like this, and she got angry, and she shouted. And we were all sitting at the same table. And she said, if you don't come and have sex with me right now, I'll never speak to you again. And we all looked at him. And then he got up very humbly and he walked out with her and they left. Yeah. I mean, that was the situation in Pune in 1981. You know, there was all these people running around and anyway, sorry, I don't mean to ruin your lunch by such a gross story, but that's what happened. And we all started laughing, you know, wow, this guy, you know, he's pulled by the tail by his girlfriend, you know, out from the Vaishnava Sangha. And who would have thought that now we have, you know, how many devotees? Well, in ashram maybe there's 50 or so, but outside there's hundreds of devotees, thousands, huh? More than 1,000. You know? In the little town of Pune. So, yeah. Now what's going to happen in, you know, 50 more years? Who knows? Maybe it will continue expanding and the mayor will become a devotee and, you know, and this will become like a city of Vaishnavas. Or maybe, who knows, maybe we'll make mistakes and, you know, and we'll fall down and then the whole thing will disappear. And then some other Vaishnavas will come here in 200 years and start preaching again and then revive. You know what I mean? Like that's, the history can, it changes. But in general, Mahaprabhu came in. This is, you know, we're chanting and dancing and somehow or other Prithiviti Yatra Yata Nagaradigram Sarvatra Pracharhoi Moranam Sarvatra Moranam. My name will go to all places. So that's just, it's going to happen somehow or other, but there may be some breaks in the line or whatever. Should happen pretty soon. We have more questions. Can we give the microphone to
this 27th verse? Prabhupada says that violence and war are inevitable factors in human society, between law and order.
Which verse is that? In the first chapter?
Second.
27. 27. Okay. Now where is that? In 27 commentary.
Yeah.
Can you read it again?
Violence and war are inevitable factors in human society for keeping law and order.
The end of Chatasihi. violence and war are inevitable factors in human society for keeping law and order. Okay.
In the Vedic time, how did each other sort of to get others' kingdom, or for what reason? Like, there were many kings that during Krishna's time, they would have,
the kings try to expand their kingdoms for the benefit of the citizens. It wasn't that they were always a bigger kingdom, you know. Although surely that, you know, occasionally would spring up, I'm sure. But, you know, in human society, people are still humans, even in the Vedic times. There's always some competition. I mean, even the demigods, they compete with each other. So then what to speak of the kings here on the earth? So, the, you know, one king may see some weakness in another kingdom, in another state, and then he may go there to take control of the place, and there may be some fight. So then they have to protect their land and their kingdom from the other person. But it's not always that the person who is attacking is like, you know, the bad guy, so to speak, the aggressor. Well, but what was your point?
Why did it fight?
No. Why the kings have to attack other kings? Is it for only for this keeping law and order, or for their own ends? Because also we learned that at that time there was one king who was ruling over the whole sort of, like, say, Duryodhan. He was supposed to be in charge of the whole planet. So why is the necessity of many kings at that time?
No, he's the emperor. The person at Hastinapur is the emperor, the king of kings. And the others are the smaller kingdoms. You know, just like there's mayors of a town, and then there's a prime minister. Or you have also have, you know, government. You have a governor of the state of maybe Maharashtra. And then you have mayors of Bombay, Pune, and all of these towns. Right. So that is good for management. You can't, you know, one administration in one central office somewhere can't take care of the whole place. There has to be other kings. And those kings pay tax to the emperor. Right. And in this way, they submit themselves to the emperor. And they pay their tax. That's just a, you know, Vedic system with kings, the monarch system. So there's always a little push and shove between the kings. They're always, you know, trying to get a little bit more. We give them the benefit of the doubt that they're doing it for the citizens. Nowadays, there's no question of that, though, you know. People are just completely selfish. But you're talking about Vedic times, so we understand that people were more pure then. Now, their violence is also necessary for the particular kingdom, because there's rogues and thieves. Other than just kings and the king's armies, there's also bands of thieves which attack, you know, everybody. So those kings also have to fight them.
Karma yoga, jnana yoga, ashtanga yoga are also part of transcendence. So
we say that Neha Vikram and Ashwasti, so that shloka, whatever little they have done, so whether it applies to all these also or only with bhakti?
Well, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur quotes from the Bhagavatam some verses, and we could dig them up for you if you need the reference, maybe later. But there he says that, you know, karma yoga is not quite the same. It doesn't give the same result. And so when it nehabhikramanashasti, that is, according to Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, so this is nirgun bhakti, that it brings this effect. But then again, so that's the difference between karma yoga and bhakti, and nirgun bhakti. In between that, there's jnana and ashtanga yoga, right? So, from chapter 6, we have to look and we see that the person who doesn't finish his ashtanga yoga, then he begins from that point in the next life. So we see that principle applies for ashtanga yoga. And, you know, I mean, Krishna doesn't make statements about jnana yogis, but it would seem that it would apply for them as well. Anyway, maybe we'll have to do some more research about this point. Right. But doesn't necessarily say that he keeps all the benefit of the previous life, but there's some indication there, yeah. There's some indication that he kind of progresses, and that's a kind of continuity must be there, huh?
So that verse Krishna says, anyone who performs the auspicious activity, you know, that will never be, you know, destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually 6.40.
Uh-huh.
That actually Prabhupada includes, as you were saying just now, last paragraph of 6th chapter 48 verse.
Uh-huh.